another episode of the Her Story Speaks podcast, a podcast dedicated to sharing the sacred and powerful stories of women who have too often gone unheard, but are most often the ones we need to be listening to. I'm your host, Andrea Miller, and I'm joining you from Kansas City, Missouri, on the native lands of the Kaw and Kickapoo Nations. My guest for episode 124 is a woman whose work I came upon a couple of years ago as I had begun my journey on my path away from patriarchal religion and discovering the sacred feminine. Liz Childs Kelly is a writer, award-winning researcher, educator, community builder, and host of the popular Home to Her podcast, which is dedicated to amplifying the voices of the sacred feminine. She's also the author of the book Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path to the Sacred Feminine, and she's founder of the Home to Her Academy, all projects she is dedicated to honoring the wisdom of the sacred feminine. Liz's writings have also been featured in a variety of online publications, including Forbes, Mashable, Rebel Society, Human Parts, and Braided Way, as well as the God Girl Books anthology, Just As I Am, Hymns Affirming the Divine Feminine. An initiated priestess in the 13 Moon lineage, she also holds certifications in Reiki, as well as Vinyasa and Yin Yoga. In this episode, Liz shares her story of walking her own path to the sacred feminine and why she's dedicated her life's work to amplifying all aspects of her. In honor of Women's History Month, we talk about the ancient her story of the sacred feminine, how she shows up today, and all the ways she drives our social justice work. This is a topic I absolutely love talking about, and I was just so thrilled to have this conversation with Liz. I can't wait for you to listen in. Liz, welcome to the Her Story Speaks podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you, Andrea.
Goodness, as we were just chatting before, it's such an honor to have you on, and you've been on my list. I was actually looking when I first downloaded your book, Home to Her, and we'll talk about that. It was March of last year when I downloaded and read your entire book. So it's been a year since I read your book, and I loved just rereading lots of it for this episode to prepare to talk to you. So like I just said, you are an author of the book Home to Her, with a podcast of the same name and an academy of the same name. So we have lots of similarities in our story and our path, but you're way far ahead of me in discovering the sacred feminine. So we're going to talk about all of that today, Liz. So welcome. And thank you again for joining me.
I'm excited. Let's do it.
Okay. So tell me just a second where you are in the world, kind of what your day-to-day life is before we dive into your story and talk about all things sacred feminine.
Yeah, I am located in central Virginia near Charlottesville on the ancestral lands of the Monacan Nation. And you know, this divine feminine work is my work. So I host a podcast, comes out every new moon and full moon. I teach courses on this. You mentioned my book, but this is my work, in addition to mothering my two amazing kids.
It is. And I think I discovered your podcast before the book. I just don't know. I didn't read your book sooner, but it has been just so helpful to me on my own journey of discovering and learning more about the sacred feminine. And like I said, your journey started well before mine. Mine was about 2019, 2020, leaving the church and white patriarchal Father God-based religion and discovering her. And I know you have your own story that we'll get into of how you discovered the sacred feminine. But before we do you mind just sharing a little bit about your origin story, maybe your early faith background, and just kind of all the things that started in your childhood that made you who you are today?
Yeah. I grew up in Georgia, so outside of Atlanta, small town outside of Atlanta. And I was raised in a Southern Baptist church. And I know that that conjures up things for people. I would say, as far as Southern Baptist goes, it wasn't progressive is not the right word, but it wasn't an all-consuming experience. It was very much like I was expected to be a Southern Baptist, but we were more of like a church on Sunday kind of family, as opposed to it being all Wednesday nights too, I guess, if I'm being honest. Wednesday night and Sunday, we were in church. Mm-hmm. But that was the lensing, spiritually, what I had. But I also, my first 7 years, I grew up, my parents had a house with several acres out, out in the county. And so my earliest memories are wandering that land and how magical and amazing it was to go on these tromps through the woods with my dog and sometimes my family. And so I had this love of nature that got instilled really early on and knew that it was a special place for me. And there was, it wasn't until much later that I realized the sacredness of that experience of nature. But for me, there, those were two separate things. There was God, who was supposed to be in church, and Jesus. And then there was this experience that I was having outside in the world, which felt like where I belonged. And I stayed, you know, I was a seeker. I think even as a young kid, Southern Baptist faith, you choose when you decide to get baptized, as opposed to some other faiths where you're baptized at birth. And I remember choosing to be baptized. I think I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I have a very clear memory of like walking up to the front of the church when they ask if anybody wants to be saved. And it was so clear to me that I was ready. Like I was ready for a spiritual initiation. Of course, I had no idea what that meant, but I felt ready for it. And in the Baptist faith, there's a large back area to the church where there's a baptismal pool where you can go and be witnessed in front of the entire congregation when you do this. So that happened a few weeks later, I think. And you get a full submersion. It's not just being sprinkled over the head with water. And so I was so excited about this. I remember walking out with my minister, who I really did like. He was a wonderful man, and being in the robe and all ready for this. And he puts his hand over my mouth and nose, and I baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And I'm dipped backwards and rise up out of the water, and nothing felt different. Like just nothing. It was so disappointing to me. Like I thought that I was going to be let in on some sort of spiritual secrets or something. There's some kind of wisdom that was going to be transmitted to me. Right. And there wasn't. I got a lot of congratulations from older congregation members and from my family. But it started sort of a feeling of disconnect, of this wanting this deep spiritual connection, and really not knowing that there was anywhere else to get it besides the church, and just feeling that disconnect. And that continued throughout, I mean, really my 20s. And I'm a well-educated person, and I'm a curious person, but I feel like it's important to emphasize that if you are surrounded by people who share the same worldview, you just don't know what you don't know. So in my early 20s, I started branching out and looking at what felt like more progressive forms of Christianity. And I kept trying, like really trying to find this church home, as my mother would refer to it. Like I wanted that. And I couldn't, just none of them worked for me. Everywhere I landed it, there was no resonance.
As you talking about your baptism story, I just like got a pang in my heart, because I never, like, just thinking about baptizing you in the name of the Father, like same experience. I was baptized in a Baptist church. Both of my daughters were, and that's the words that were spoken over us. And so only seeing God as a Father, as He, I'm guessing, was your experience as a child. And then, like you said, into your 20s, still searching. And I wrote, you said that in your book, I hoped I'd find a progressive faith home in Christianity. Instead, I found the sacred feminine. And I think that's the story of so many of us finally discovering this path. Like you said, you're a well-educated woman. I mean, my husband have that talk all the time. Like, how did we just believe and buy into the Father God for so long? And I think it's because that's all you're surrounded by. That's the stories, that's the church you're in, that's the air you breathe. So it is like she finds you, and you have to be your like your story. And we'll talk about that when you discovered her at the business conference. But it's not something that's going to be in the air you breathe unless she finds you or you're intentional about learning her story.
Yeah. And it's interesting that I too have a podcast and have talked to many women at this point. And there are some women who they figured it out pretty early. Like even in the, I don't know how they did it. I'm so impressed, but they were like, yeah, I knew this was a load of BS from the get-go. Like we're born from women. Why, what is this? Where's the woman in the church? And I'm curious to this day why I didn't, because I was a curious kid. I was very inquisitive, you know, but I didn't think to question that piece of it until much later. I just didn't. I don't know if it was my orientation. There's a whole compounding factor that I think is found in the South about being a good girl, you know, and like really, and I could play that role really well, and I was praised for it. And so, you know, I don't know if I tamped it down for that.
I love your podcast, and it's so interesting to hear all the women's journey to the sacred feminine. And again, fascinating that some are like, yeah, I just knew it. And I think about my oldest daughter, who's 21. I remember when she was like in first grade, so highly immersed in the church, but she would always ask me like, where are the women? Or why was it Jesus a man? And not like, and I would just so blow her off. Like my mind was not even going to go there. And I think now of her curiosity at that age. And I think also while I'm so, why I'm so bent now on like putting this out there and women's stories and kind of coming against that myth of the father God. So let's dive in a little bit how you actually did encounter. You have a whole chapter in your book, and I just can't encourage listeners enough to get your book and read it in its entirety. And we're just going to skim on some or touch on some points in it today in our conversation. But for the full effect, I just really encourage everyone to get your book because the Her story in it is rich, and your story that you intertwine and the intersectionality, it's just all so, so good. So let's actually, before we get into your discovery of the sacred feminine and how she found you, can you tell me, and I will get into this a little bit more later, but some listeners might be saying, what is she talking about, sacred feminine or divine feminine? Does she just mean the goddess? What does she mean? So I know that term means a lot, but can you summarize it just in a sentence or two of what she means to you?
Yeah. So when I say sacred feminine, I'm talking about knowing spirit, source, God, however you want to describe that, with a feminine face. And when I talk about who the sacred feminine is, I usually tell people in three parts. She's a historical fact, not because that's the most important, but because I think that's the one part that we are missing the most. And I really want people to know that that's there. She's a spiritual idea and concept that I think is really balancing for those of us that have been indoctrinated into this male Father God. And then she's the lived experience of our own sacred nature. That is how I think of her. And I feel like I'm not doing her justice even to package her that tight, but that's as succinct as I can get her in my experience of her.
I think that's very helpful for everyone because it is such a massive concept and she means something different to everybody. So that's a great overview of, in a nutshell, what she means. So in your book, you say she found me at a business conference in the spring of 2014. Do you want to take us back there to that unlikely place and where you were in your life and how she possibly found you there?
Yeah. And I want to say that I had paved the way at that point for her to show up. I think I had given up on trying to find the Christian church and had gone much more into Eastern religion and philosophy. I'd studied some Buddhism. I was practicing yoga. So I'd kicked open the door to a little bit of a different way of looking at the world. And I think that was helpful, that prepared me for this. But I was at a business conference. I owned my own consulting company. And so I was there to win new clients and networking. That was a huge part of my job, business development. And I was listening to a woman speak, and her name is Dr. Elizabeth Kapu'alani Lindsay, and she's Native Hawaiian and a National Geographic Fellow and an anthropologist. And she started speaking about people that she called the wayfinders. And if anybody's got kids and has seen the movie Moana, that sort of, I don't know how accurately that kind of put these folks, I feel like, on a cultural map at a larger scale, but this was before that. And she was describing how they could travel thousands of miles between islands without any of the modern instrumentation that European sailors not only used, but assumed that everybody had to have to do this. And so they did this through a number of ways. They had oral traditions that had been passed down generation after generation. They did it by observing, like deeply, deeply paying attention to the birds and the stars and all of this. And then they used their own intuition. And so she said something to the effect of they were so in tune with the wisdom of their own hearts that they could navigate thousands of miles just by watching the way the waves broke across the front of the boat. That's how I remember it. And when she said it, I had a full body reaction. So it was very embodied experience. We started getting hot and tingly from my feet all the way up to the top of my head, and the room got very shimmery, and my vision was going in and out, and my hearing was going in and out. And it really felt like there was a cracking open of this question of like, wow, could this live in me? And as soon as the question was there, I already knew the answer. It did. Like, it absolutely did. And at that moment, I mean, I don't know how long it lasted, but it had such a profound effect on me. It was the most spiritual experience I'd ever had in my life. And it very much was like a before and after moment, or like someone had just dropped a veil. Mm. Oh, hey, this existence is so much bigger than what you think it is. And then the veil went back up, but I was hooked, absolutely hooked. I had to learn more. And so I went from a very literal place trying to learn about these wayfinders. And that actually turned out to be a good way to start, because it pushed me more towards more indigenous wisdom and traditions. And that opened up another door, you know, like kicked the door even wider to what the sacred is and what is spiritual. And that taught me that all of life is sacred. But I didn't find the feminine specifically. I didn't know that it was her that had found me until my son was born several months later. And I had been pregnant with him at the business conference. He was my second child. And I decided to have him, or at least to attempt to have him, unmedicated without any, you know, my daughter had been born very traditional with epidural and all that. And so I wanted to be fully present for it. And I did that, and it was incredible and awful, just excruciating and painful, all of these things. But a couple of really important things happened in that experience. And one of them was this understanding of like just the raw power of life that is just moving through everything, all of us. And to feel it moving through my body was just insane. So incredible. And that I had nothing to do except, in fact, it all worked best when I just got out of the way and let it do what it was meant to do. And the second part was this deep feeling of being connected to women, not just my own ancestral lineage, but all the women throughout time who had given birth. And I really felt like at certain points that they were in the room with me as this was happening. And so after that experience, I went home with my baby, just like, whoa, I think childbirth might be the most spiritual experience anybody can have. And I was genuinely confused that I had not encountered this concept before. Like, I just didn't get it. Even from the more recent studies I'd done after the business conference, I wasn't finding this concept, and I couldn't figure out why. And then on a very ordinary day, I was just at home with my newborn thinking about this, and it really just kind of hit me out of the blue. I'm like, oh, well, everything I've been reading lately has been written by men. And then that just was like an opening of like this flood, this cascade of realization of going back to my childhood of how God was a man and his sacred child was a man. And the preachers were men, and the deacons who got to stand up and serve in the church were men. And even in my, you know, seeking and Buddhism and whatnot, I'd been shown men, all men, and the teachers had been men. And there was no way they could tell me about the sacredness of what it means to bring life into the world because they had not experienced it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. And even with that, and we don't have to get into that, but it's just like how women are taught to give birth, laying down on their back, very passive, epidural, not feeling it, which were both at my births. And that's just what you do. But it's like, I think there's a deeper reason for all of that. And you experiencing that connection and birthing and that connection with the divine feminine and the creator, creatrix, all of that, like, is so, so powerful. And I just can imagine if all women felt that when with their birth. But that was the way that she found you. And you say that within a year of your son's birth, you sold your company, dedicated your life to finding her, learning her stories, and feeling her wisdom in your bones. That's powerful, Liz. Like she had you.
She really did. It was clear when I figured out, you know, when I had that realization about, oh wow, it's all been men. That temporarily broke me. Yeah. It really did, because I felt betrayed, because I did consider myself a spiritual seeker and a devotee of the divine, even though I didn't know how to describe that. And so I had this moment of feeling like I'd just been told that the divine didn't think my experiences were worthy. Mm-hmm. But I very quickly realized, and again, it was based on the intuitive experiences that I'd had, that was wrong.
That's
that
right.
All of life was sacred, that I was sacred, and that there had to be a feminine face of God, that there must be. And now I'm like, well, of course there is. It's been, you know, 10 years researching this, but at the time it was revelatory and I didn't know what it meant. And it also, when that realization came in, it was very clear that this was a very important part of why I was here in this lifetime, and that I was supposed to do it not just for me, but for others. And I don't mean that in a grandiose, like capitalist sort of way, but that it was bigger than me. Like this was not just like a curiosity. This would be a fun thing to learn. It was like, no, you showed up in this lifetime for a reason and you just landed on it. So let's let go of the business. Like this has been good. It's fed you. You've gotten what you needed to get out of it, but let's get down to why you're really here.
And that's what I love about you and your story and your honesty, is because you're so real and don't hide anything about being a white woman in this space and having ancestry of both being colonized and being a colonizer. And I think, you know, I've stayed away a little bit from having Goddess Divine Feminine talk on my podcast, because I think it can be kind of a toxic, problematic space sometimes with white women in it. So I love just how honest you are with that. And like you've said, part of your mission with this, in your book, you talk about like being the one in your family line of like stepping away from that patriarchal faith and being honest about all of these things. So thank you for that part of your story. And I also resonate with that. But again, I just admire the intersectionality also that you talk about within your sacred feminine teaching and practice. So can you touch on that a little bit? You did a whole episode on it, but some people might be also wondering like how is intersectionality brought into this and what does she mean by that?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I have to say, like when I started this work, it really just was about me and my own liberation. And that is not a bad place to start. I think that's actually makes a lot of sense. We start with where we are locked down and oppressed, and we crack that open and we start to see it. And so there's nothing wrong with that being the right place to start. But it was almost like once that door got opened for me, there was no way that I could not see how this limited view of the world, which I see starting. Okay, I'm not going to say starting. There is no start point, right? That just gets too simplistic to me. But if we think about where we are in the United States, European patriarchy, which is built on the oppression of women, went on to spawn colonialism, which went on to spawn racism and heteronormativity, like all of these things, it all kind of cycles back up to the same place. And so to only talk about my oppression and the way that I had been held back at the same time when I could see that I have had a lot of advantages as a white woman, and also my ancestors, my female ancestors, because they're white, they had the option at least to align themselves with powerful white men, which gave them privilege, even if it also oppressed them. It was both. So to not acknowledge that would be dishonest, and it would be out of integrity for me. I also think that this is why the sacred feminine has come to so many people and not just me. Like, yes, let's free ourselves. Let's do that. And I absolutely believe in that principle of when we change ourselves, we do change the world around us. But if we stay in that individual lane and like, it's just about me and my freedom, and now I'm going to go translate that into a capitalist hierarchical sense of like, I'm going to go get mine because I deserve it, without the lens of all of life being sacred. And when I cast that net, now I'm talking about my human kin, I'm talking about all kin, all of them. If I'm not including all of that, then I'm not honoring what she's teaching. And that is what the sacred feminine is about. So it can't, it's out of alignment for me to not speak about all those things. And that was something that took me kind of years to understand. It really did. And then I had to get really uncomfortable because, you know, I guess if I'm going to be, you know, yucky honest, it's, there's something that feels good about being able to name your own oppression when you haven't been able to say it. And there's a way in which you can kind of want to hang on to that because there's some kind of empowerment around like that victimhood or like, oh no, wait, I have been hurt by you and I want to stay here and I want to be mad about it. And I want to say, what about me? What about me? What about me? And that's okay. That's a necessary part of the process, I think. But yeah, if I stay there, it's not enough.
Right. And with that, I'm thinking about, I thought I wrote it in my notes, but in your book where you say, and I think this ties in, we have a mistake or a disservice when we try to just narrow down, oh, the suppression of the sacred feminine is all patriarchy. Like that does a disservice to our indigenous humans and other cultures that are still and have not had her suppressed as those growing up in white Christianity have.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, and this is, if you start to look around at the evidence of the sacred feminine, and one of the challenges that I have when people talk about a linear narrative. Well, first of all, the sacred feminine is not linear. Any linear narrative is coming from humans and informed by patriarchy, I think. So, but there's a storyline that is like, patriarchy killed the goddess. Well, that is giving them way too much credit. First of all, it's not possible to kill her. And second of all, if you look around at indigenous cultures, in many of them, they still have an understanding of the sacred feminine. They never lost it. And if they did lose it, they didn't lose it 10,000 years ago. They lost it because my ancestors showed up on this soil 300 years ago, 500 years ago, and stomped it out of them. And so this is another reason why I feel like we cannot just talk about the sacred feminine from that patriarchal bucket, because it's just, it's inaccurate and it's incomplete.
So good and so true. Let's dive in a little bit. We could, all of these topics, we could like dive so much deeper into, Liz. So again, this is just such a brief overview for listeners. But like you said at the beginning, the sacred feminine is a spiritual idea, a historical fact, and a direct live experience. So we're going to dive in a little bit to the historical fact, given that it is Women's History Month. And we're just going to go way back to pre-her story, before written word, and just touch on that a little bit. I've taken a couple of your courses, but one that really dives into this, and we'll make sure to put links for that for our listeners. And I've given some workshops on this as well, but it's really fascinating when you dive into the her story of this. So I don't know, where do you want to start on this? There's a, like you said in your book, there's a mountain of evidence that testifies to the presence of an ancient female source of all creation that was worshipped by our ancestors for thousands of years. And we can even go pre-human. Maybe we want to start there. Like, let's do that, because that's just fascinating. I learned that in your course. So why don't we start there, and then we'll move our way forward just a little bit.
Yeah, well, some people, if your listeners are into this, they might have heard of these so-called Venus figurines, which is a really problematic name that maybe we'll talk about if we have time. But this is generally a name that's given to these Paleolithic figurines that are, in some cases, 30, 40,000 years old. And the vast majority are women. There have definitely been animals found as well. But in terms of humans, the vast majority are women, and they have very similar characteristics. They're not all exactly the same, but a lot of them are. But there are a couple of these so-called Venus figurines that actually predate humanity, which is really fascinating. So you got to go back even pre-Neanderthal. We're talking Homo erectus is the name of the species. And there's a little pebble that was found in Israel. It's thought to be 250,000 years old. It's called the Venus of, I'm doing air quotes, the Venus of Barakat Ram. And the archaeologists that found it looked at it and thought, gosh, this really looks like a figure of a woman. It looks like somebody used a tool to shape breasts. And like, you know, if you hold her in the profile, you can see that. This created all kinds of controversy, which is what happens when you dig into sacred feminine history. We can come up with a million different reasons why it's not her. And there was a lot of debate on whether or not this figurine was even shaped by the forces of time or the forces of somebody else, some other being. And there was a lot of study that was done on it. And the general conclusion is that, yes, some being took a tool, saw this, had the foresight to think, hey, this could become a woman potentially. We'll never know for sure, right? Who knows? Like, we don't have writing. We can't talk to them. And then created that. So it's just fascinating in general, the assumptions that we have about when civilization started and what our species is capable of doing. And even the species before us, the fact that they can think like that, that's fairly sophisticated stuff. And then the fact that it's a woman, or at least a female form, is even more beautiful. And like I said, we won't know for sure, but I find that absolutely fascinating and frankly annoying that, you know, I had to dive pretty deep to find this. It's like, I feel like we all should know this.
That's right. Never anything that we've learned in all of our schooling or college schooling, any of it. And I'll put a link to a picture of her and some more information on the show notes for this episode. And I think we should touch on the whole Venus thing, because then we have the Venus of Willendorf, all of them, and why that term is problematic. I mean, I know, but if you want to just share that, because I think that's important to know, because that's kind of what her story has been reduced to, of the love goddess or whatever. So if you want to just share on that, why that is problematic.
Yeah, the name, and I learned this from Max DeShue, who runs something called Suppressed Histories Archives, and she has amassed just incredible amount of information, not just about women's histories, but Indigenous people's histories as well. And the term came from a French aristocrat, I believe, early 20th century, found one of these figurines on his property and was struck by the fact that this woman, her breast and her vulva are on clear display. There's no hiding. There's no body shame, where if you look at later Greek and Roman art, you'll often see the goddess with one arm draped modestly across her breast and her knees, you know, glued together. And so almost as a joke, I think he called it Venus impudique, the immodest Venus. And that name of Venus got stuck on all of these figurines. And there are many hundreds that have been found that span thousands of years and a geographic distance going from Spain all the way over to Siberia. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible. And most of them, I mean, really all of them that I've seen, their bodies are on full display. Many of them don't have feet. A lot of them are much rounder than what we would expect, or what we see as the feminine ideal in our culture today. So these are bodies that like have breasts that sag and fuller bellies and big butts, you know, just really, really beautiful. I think the Venus term has stuck also because there's been assumptions that these are fertility items, as if we can't imagine that there would be any other reason to make a form of a woman than, you know, or like it's a cultish object. I even saw a reference to them as perhaps prehistoric porn. Right. I know. So, I mean, it's just, again, this is all speaks to the limitations of the viewpoint of the person who's looking at it and then who has the microphone to tell us what they're looking at.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And like you were just saying, I mean, I have that poster in my wall from, I think it's Max Duchet's organization, but the Goddess Timeline. And it's fascinating. And I've copied this from your book. To date, more than 250 figurines of women have been found in sites across Europe, with several more discovered in Siberia and Eastern Russia, thought to be close to 40,000 years old. And it's like scattered across 4,000 miles. You find some very, very similar of the statues. And like you said, big breasts, vulvas, like big thighs, bellies, all these things in women that were worshipped. And it's not a stretch to see that they saw women giving birth, Mother Earth, like women being the creators, creatrixes, like why wouldn't they associate women with the goddess or sacred feminine, or just the reverence they had for women's bodies. And then it's so, we don't have time to get into this, but like you just said, over time and patriarchy and colonialism, like women's bodies being shamed and blamed. And of course, Christianity, but we don't have time to get into all of that, but so it's just, it's so fascinating. And another fact in your book, approximately 30,000 goddess sculptures have been found in Southern Europe from the Neolithic time period alone.
Yes. Absolutely amazing. And then they look different from that time period. You know, they start to take on different shapes, and there's lots of, you'll see symbols on them, like spirals or chevrons, particular designs on them. Their pubic triangle is now marked by a literal triangle in a lot of them, as opposed to like being more clearly stylized as a vulva. But yeah, it's amazing. I mean, there really is, to me, and this is where I don't think we should get hung up on, am I looking at a goddess or not? Like, this is just a pointless conversation as far as I'm concerned. But I think what we are seeing is that there's something about the feminine that is considered sacred, and so sacred that it needs to be represented over and over and over again in these figurines. And that, I think, is incredibly powerful. And I think our imagination and interpretation that we give to that is totally valid. Like, yes, let's listen to the archaeologists and the experts, but they don't know, right? We don't have, these people cannot speak to us themselves. This is still pre-written language. And so I think being with these things and seeing them and understanding how you feel when you respond to them is a valid form of research and inquiry as any other.
Yeah, that's right. And that goes to why you use the term sacred feminine instead of goddess or divine feminine. And that makes perfect sense. It's like, we can get rid of all the controversy, but what we know from these facts is women's body, it was sacred. And there's no denying that when you look at the archaeological evidence for that. And from what I've read, and you can correct me, there's very little, and in some cases, no male representation in some of these periods with sculptures, which in itself is fascinating.
Totally. Yeah. And again, and also a lot of this that we know of, it has come from Europe. But what I would say about that too, and I think Max Deschoux has done a nice job with this, looking at later time periods of some similar figurines, but we also have to remember that people are just working with what they have. So if in their environment, we just don't know. There could be other things that have just not lasted, you know, because they were carved out of wood instead of stone.
And I was going to, thank you for that, because I was going to ask you that, like, why so much of the evidence and archaeological evidence is Europe, and we know as humans, theory likely we originated all from Africa. So why are we not seeing it, because it could have been made from wood, or just sources, or just material that did not last as long?
I've heard that. And then the other thing that I just honestly don't know enough about is climate. Yeah. And what, you know, if climate would have played a role in preserving particular materials that, you know, perhaps lasted in Europe, for example, but didn't last in Africa. But I think, you know, there's this beautiful, beautiful painting on a rock wall in what is now Algeria, so Northern Africa. Her name is the running, sometimes she's called the running goddess or the running horned woman. And this is thought to be at least 10,000 years old, I believe. I got to look at my book now, but I think it's 8,000 to 10,000 years old. Absolutely spectacular of this woman in profile running. And there's so many things that I love about her. One is that she is black. She is very clearly black. And I think sometimes this conversation about the sacred feminine, because of the old evidence, is focused in Europe. It just, I don't know. And people who are of European descent have the microphone. They tend to focus on that piece, but she is a beautiful example of a black sacred feminine. And again, we don't know if she's a priestess, or the term shaman is problematic, but like a medicine woman for her people, or a goddess, but she is very clearly the sacred feminine. So we know that there is evidence going back at least 10,000 years in other parts of the world too, for sure.
Absolutely. And it's not a stretch to say really in every civilization, prehistoric, historic, there are signs of the sacred feminine, her existence there. Would you agree?
Everything that I've seen, like, I don't know every culture, but everything that I've seen, we find her. And I think if you start to look long enough, you're like, well, of course, like, why would we carve off half of the human species and decide that it's lesser? Like, it makes absolutely no sense. So,
And I'll put links, like, we barely scratched the surface here. I'll put links, of course, to your book, but there's so many others that listeners can dive a little bit deeper into. So let's fast forward a little bit to written word. All this was before her story was written down, and symbolism was so important. So written word, this is something so fascinating as far as women's herstory. You want to share a little bit about that?
Well, again, like you start to find references to goddesses, like once we have the written word all over the place. Our first known poet is a priestess named Inhe Duwana, who wrote poems and verses in honor of her beloved goddess Inanna. Powerful, powerful stuff. And we have it. It's translated. You can read it. It's phenomenal. You know, there's also evidence in early Christianity from Gnosticism. There's an incredible poem called Thunder, Perfect Mind, that is very clearly written in a divine feminine voice that was found in Egypt. There's the Festus disc that was found in Crete, which is written in a script called Linear A, that again, there's a lot of controversy around it, but there's a man who's been working on translating it for the last 30 years or so. And in 2021, he said he felt very clearly that he had, and it was in honor of a goddess, actually two goddesses. So there's all of these references that we find to the sacred feminine in writing too. And this is where she starts to get interesting, you know, because in some places she has become a consort to a god, or in other ways, she's very complex. Like if you read about Inanna, she could be motherly. She can be really bawdy in terms of sexually, and she can be absolutely cruel and vindictive. And I honestly think that that representation of the sacred feminine and just the sacred in general is so helpful. Like we just need that to break us out of this binary of like good and bad and what is evil and what is not. And so that's just another reason where I'm like, oh, the sacred feminine has so much to offer us.
Yeah. Yeah. And that goes back to one of your points in the book. Like she encompasses all things. She's infused in all things. And it's not just what's quote good and pure, so much more and so many more dimensions to her than that. I wish we could go on about more of the her story, but people are just going to have to read more and get your book. Cause I want to bring us up a little bit to present day. Cause like you say, you would be in your book, you'd be doing her a disservice if you acted like she was all in the past, but she's now, she's right now, she's in the present in other cultures, infused in the earth, infused in us. Like she's right here, right now. And one of those ways is the way that she can drive social justice work. So I want to get into that a little bit. And I know this could get a little sticky, but perhaps for you, from your own experience, how is she driving your own social justice work? And there's so many ways that this can go.
Yeah. Well, I think this goes back to what I was saying earlier, that if I treat this work as only being fueled by making my life better personally, like then I'm not really honoring what she's teaching. I mean, to be honest, like my life is pretty damn good. You know, I am comfortable. I have a roof over my head. I have food. My children are safe. Right. All of that is there. And so the sacred feminine, one of the biggest things that she has taught me is this idea that all of life is sacred. This is connected to the idea too of immanence, meaning as opposed to a transcendent God, which is what we know through Christianity, which God, you know, made the world, right? But he's not in it. He's just like floating up there in the sky somewhere, looking down and judging us on whether or not we're doing well. The world is the goddess. Like there is no separation. And so that means each of us is an expression of her too. And so that means my existence is as her emissary. And so this world it's not mine to save. Like there's a real dance here between like the white savior complex, right? But there is a call to responsibility, to recognize like that intertwining of the sacredness of all life and the acknowledgement that my actions can and do make a difference. And all of them make a difference, the small ones and the big ones. And I think that is really liberating because it gives us a path forward for everyday activism in the ways that we feel called to do so. And so, for example, right now, I'm so moved by you, Andrea, and everybody else who is speaking up about what's happening in Gaza. That is huge. And that is just a no-brainer to me of like, no, we aren't going to let children die. Like, we're not going to let life die over some, we have the capabilities to solve our problems in different ways. And so we can lend our voices in that way. There's also all kinds of things in our communities as well. You know, I just learned recently that nearly 40% of Americans are living below the poverty line. What the holy hell?
Right.
How is this okay? You know, right. So I think to me, the sacred feminine is the recognition that as an expression of her, we have power. And I think this is especially true of white women who are perhaps sitting on some trauma that our ancestors passed down to us. So many of us, we don't have to tamp ourselves down. We have education, we have economic means. So it's a matter of just finding the courage and saying, I'm not going to let those things stop me. I am going to show up and use that power. And then I'm going to direct it in the best way that I know how. And I'm going to completely release any attachment to outcome, because that's bigger than me. And I'm part of this interwoven web of life. And I recognize that it's bigger than me, but I am going to show up and I am going to give. That is a huge, huge part of the sacred feminine. And I love her for that, because I feel like she calls me to a higher standard every day, whatever that means for me, yeah. You know?
Liz, you're giving me chills and making me tear up some. Like, you're just voicing so much of what I have felt inside, that I think, especially as white women, we need to hear, because so much of this space is this love and light. And that's not all that it is. Like, you just went back to talking about Inanna. No, it's not. It's not just that. And I think so many caught up in this space can think that, but that's when it's very much centered on yourself. And, you know, talking about Gaza, there's been a real big divide, I think, right now, also in the sacred feminine space, of women not speaking up or speaking up or just continuing the love and light. But I don't know how you cannot speak up when mothers and children, not that the men are not important, of course they are, but the sacred feminine, of course, would be advocating for the mothers and the children that are being killed at horrific numbers.
Yeah.
And also with Mother Earth being destroyed. I mean, that's the other tie-in with me, especially, is the ecofeminism. One of the sacred, like you say in your book, one of the sacred feminine's most recognizable traits is her connection to nature, especially our Mother Earth. And there's such, and you can probably speak more into this, but there's such a tie-in with the raping and destroying Mother Earth, and then destroying and raping of women. And to me, that is so profound.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, who thinks it's okay to murder their mother? And that is what we're doing. And I think that only works in a storyline that has humans as separate from nature, not existing completely intertwined with nature. And that goes back again to that idea of eminence, you know, like, yes, like the sacred feminine is in all things. And so she's in the plants, in the ants, in the stones. It's all, you know, it's interesting too, because if you really, there is a lot for me, a similarity between animacy and the sacred feminine. And I sometimes wonder if my own exploration of the sacred feminine as I go farther in it was really just a way to put me on this path of indigeneity. In my own European ancestors. And I think that goes back to animacy, and that the sacred feminine is the piece that has been most destroyed. So she's just opened that way to me to see, like, I'm just going to show you, but you don't even have to call me she, if you're going to go sit out in the woods and connect with the trees. You know, like it's all her, and you don't have to call it her. This is all sacred.
Yes. Oh, Liz, I'm looking at the time. So much more I want to keep talking about. Before I ask you, in all the places that you can be found, because there's so many ways my listeners can connect with you, I'd love to know, and I think you've alluded to it a little bit, the connection with nature, but what other practices do you have with connecting with her, perhaps daily, annually, that sort of thing? Or maybe it's just a daily practice of connecting with her, because I do think that's important, not to go back into like the patriarchy, morning quiet time reading the Bible, but I think the connection with her is part of this journey that's been helpful for me. So I'm curious what your practices are.
Yeah, I think she is most available. Maybe I am most available to her. My mind is quietest in those pre-dawn hours. So that is a really rich time for me. And I meditate, but I would call it listening to her. So it's not so much like clear my mind. Yes, I try to quiet my mind. But if messages and wisdom and insight come in as part of that, that is very welcome. And as part of that, I have a practice of, and these are just things that have come to me, of honoring my ancestors every morning, honoring the four directions, honoring my place in this web of life, calling in protection and asking it to be around me, rooting my energy to the earth every day, which is a really beautiful and powerful practice. And I think if you do it enough, you start to connect to the land itself. Like it's you, you can, I have found that you can feel what's underneath you. And it's different, Andrea, where you are as opposed to where I am. The dirt is different. The rocks are different. The water underneath is different. So that's a powerful practice that I have as well. And then I pray a divine feminine inspired rosary. We don't have time to unpack all that, I know. But for me, I have found a way to honor my ancestors by picking up this practice. My ancestors, as far back as I know, were Christian. And so I have found a way to adopt the rosary in a very divine feminine way that strips out the things that I feel like are the overlay of patriarchal Christianity. And that's a prayer practice directly to the Divine Mother that I do every day. And then I honor some of the seasons of the wheel. I know that that is more of a newer pagan thing that's been adopted, and not all of that is known for sure about my own ancestral people, but there are certain ones of those particular turns of the season that are very rich and potent for me. And those are things like the winter solstice and the equinoxes are in particular. Those have a, they have an energy to me, a vibration. And so if I have time, I try to create ritual for me and then also family practices to bring in with my children too.
Thank you for that. And I appreciate you sharing that not as a prescription for my listeners, because there is no prescription like in some of the other patriarchal religions of what you must do to follow her or be saved or accepted. That's not the case. It's so much about finding your own way and your own method to connect with her. And that's just some beautiful examples of ways to do it. And like prayer, that could be a really hard, and you share about that more in detail in your book. I mean, I know for me, that's still a really hard one coming out of the religious spaces I was in, but totally I love the journey of reconnecting with that and reclaiming that space. And that's so much what this journey is about. Oh, Liz, our time is coming to an end. I have just appreciated so, so much this just brief overview of your journey and your book. Can you tell my listeners all the places that you can be found? And we'll put that in the show notes, but I know there's so many with the book, podcast, your academy, all the things.
Yeah. So hometoher.com is a great place to start because you'll find a link to courses. You'll find a link to the podcast, but it's also the Home to Her podcast. So wherever you get your podcast. And then the book can be found, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine, can be found wherever you buy your books. I just recorded the audio version of it, so I'm not sure when that's going to come out, but I just got out of the studio last week. So that should be available on Audible. Hopefully at some point in the very near future. And then if it's okay to mention, I do have a course coming up and it's about land stewardship. So it is about moving into deeper conversation with the land. And I will be teaching this with a friend who has been stewarding a property in Mount Shasta, California for the last 10 years. And so we're doing an in-person retreat on the property and then a 3-week post-integration that is really about learning how to listen very deeply to land. And so that you're moving into conversation with it. So you're not directing it or figuring out how I can get what I need out of you, but really being in dialogue. And so that kicks off on April 25th and it runs through May 19th.
Saw that on your website this morning, Liz, and I'm so congratulations on, you know, as you prepare to launch that, that sounds amazing. And then your book, congratulations, just recording that. I know, and I'll mention this to in the show notes, but it's a Nautilus Gold Award winner in 2023. So congratulations just on all the things. Like you are such an inspiration. And if people go to your website, you have a prompt right off that they can get like a free grounding meditation, which is so beautiful. So I encourage listeners to go there, go all the places, and we'll put lots of links in the show notes here. Yeah, Liz, just thank you. So grateful for your voice and your work. And your time.
Thank you so much. It's such a joy to be in conversation on my most favorite topic, and especially with you. So thank you for having me.
As I mentioned in this episode, we barely scratched the surface on bringing you just some of the wisdom of the sacred feminine. No matter where you are in your journey of discovering her, I can't recommend enough Liz's book, Home to Her.
As always, in the show notes for this episode at herstoryspeaks.com, I have all the links to the things that Liz mentioned, as well as a list of some of my favorite resources on connecting with the sacred feminine.